All right, welcome to Baptist Basics University. Our course is Baptist History. This is lesson number 10, the final lesson in this series, as of now, unless I just happen to add another one. But anyway, in this lesson, we're going to deal with Independent Fundamental Baptists. Now, if you have an older set of notes, I did have a different lesson 10 that I had never recorded the lecture to. And if so, you need to go back to the website and get the new lesson notes, because I decided to change this for a number. The original lesson was kind of a hip hip hooray kind of lesson for Baptists across the world and all the good things that they were doing and how they had great mission fields in Korea and Mexico and different things like that, and talked about how big numbers are. And it was neat. But it just didn't seem to fit with the series of lessons that we've been doing. So I finally got a chance and reworked this. Now, in the last lesson, we dealt with Baptists in America, and we've kind of, you know, we've built up to this point to where I'd like to cover, you know, the origins and history of the Independent Fundamental Baptist movement, which is a difficult thing to do because not many people have written on it. There's very few books actually written on the subject. So there's not just a whole lot of readily available information on it. But there is definitely a need there for something on it. And so what I'd like to do is just kind of address that need in a small way, at least maybe have an opening shot at it. Maybe somebody else will come along and expand on it, or if time allows, maybe I'll be able to. But what we're going to do in this lesson is just kind of cover the thoughts behind it, and we'll get a lot in specifics and deal with the different groups and people. Just because, for one, it's very difficult because the Independent Fundamental Baptist movement is a very loose-knit movement. There are different groups of people. Sometimes you hear them called camps, that will rally around a regional or maybe a national entity. So, you know, for instance, there are a number of fundamental Baptists that will run with the kind of in a crowd that's based on the Sword of the Lord newspaper. There's also another crowd that runs around the Revival Fires paper, which is not quite as large. Well, in some cases, there's people that are in both of those camps, and in some cases, there's some that just do not get along. So that what ends up being kind of two circles of influence. So that's just an example of it. That makes it very hard to study. So anyway, the Independent Fundamental Baptist movement is really kind of a union of a lot of other different movements. It really has roots in various different elements or themes or thoughts or previous movements. For one, you have the fundamentalist movement, which was that reaction and challenge to the growing tide of modernism in Christianity. You also have kind of an independent movement that where churches were getting away from denominational control and hierarchy and going to and focusing more on the local congregational government. So those are big things. Of course, you also have the Baptist movement, which I contend lasted almost 2,000 years, but you have that movement too. So it's really a union of many different things. There's a lot of different influences on it. So now, what's some of the key thoughts behind the Independent Fundamental Baptist movement? Well, there's a couple of key Baptist distinctives that really set the groundwork and lay the foundation for the Independent Fundamental Baptist movement. The first is the doctrine of biblical authority. Kind of the back to the source mentality. What has happened is a lot of people over the years have rejected the false teachings, or traditions of their churches and leaders, and gone back and said, "What does the Bible say?" And to an extent, that's what Luther did in the Reformation. Even Luther, you know, he got back to the Bible away from Catholicism and its teachings and realized that they had some errors. Now, he never really completely came out, and I think we talked a little bit about that. But it's that same type of mentality. We're going to get back. What does the Bible say? The Bible is going to be our authority, and if the Bible speaks on it, we're going to speak on it. If it's going to be silent, we're going to be silent on it. But we're going to try to base everything we do on biblical example, biblical authority, have a chapter and verse for everything we say. And the second thing is the autonomy of the local church, which is, a key point, because Baptists do believe that each local congregation is the church, not the large denominational structure, not all the Christians in the world. Baptists believe that, at least for the most part, as far as I know, most for the most part, believe that the church is the local congregation assembled in one place. And that local congregation has self-governing power. That's what the autonomy of the local church is. We covered that for a little bit. So when you have that aspect, you know, each congregation can go their own way. So if a congregation wants to be a little bit more conservative, that's their right and their ability to do so. If they want to be a little bit more, say, modern or liberal in their practice, that's their right and privilege to do so. So what happens is independent congregations are affected by this movement, and they decide that's what we want to do, and they will throw off the burdens and bonds of a denominational or power above them, a hierarchy above them, to seek that truer form of religion as they see it. And that's another key point to the Independent Fundamental Baptist movement, is that they believe that each church is its local congregation and has the right to govern itself and has the right just to chart its own destiny, which is really against some of the other denominational thinking. And Baptists have always been this way, but there had been a tend, especially in the 18th and 19th centuries, towards a more powerful centralized government, shall we say it that way. And that took place in the form of conventions. Well, take the Southern Baptist Convention, for example. What the deal with that, now, the churches would send what they called messengers to the conventions, and they would vote on different things and make some decisions. But at the same time, they also would develop, you know, denominational Sunday school material, which they expected people to use, and different things like that. Well, and what ends up happening is, if you're a member of a convention like that, that if it decides to go more liberal, they're going to try to flex a little bit more of power and a little bit of authority over churches that are a little bit lagging. I mean, you think about it, you're basically a bunch of churches tying themselves together, and whichever way the majority of the people want to go, you know, that's the way it goes. It's kind of like a big tug of war. So, especially in the stronger the ties are in the government and the authority, the stronger the pull is. So you know, and that can go either way. There's been a little bit of resurgence in recent years of conservatism in the Southern Baptist ranks, so it's kind of pulled back the other way to an extent. Not a great deal, but to an extent it has. Excuse me. Probably the best explanation for the beginnings of the Independent Fundamental Baptist movement is that people were waking up to the rising tide of modernism that was creeping into Christianity, and they stood against it. I believe it's the book of Isaiah talks about how when the enemy comes in his flood, the Lord will raise a standard against them. Well, that's what they did. They said, you know, here we stand. We're not changing. You're not messing with our doctrine. You're not messing with what we believe. And so all these people began to take a stand against the modernism and stuff that was creeping into Christianity. Now, this really begins to form. Now, this has been a battle for years and centuries to an extent, But it really begins to take form the late 1800s, the 19th century, when you had the people, the more traditional thought, and then the modernists. Now, those terms may not have been exactly used, but that's when the battle was really beginning. Now, there wasn't really, you know, clear-cut dividing lines, but it was beginning to form there. Biblical criticism, which, okay, criticism can be, depending on your use of the word, can be a good thing in the Bible. What criticism originally was people researching the Bible to get back to what it was in a historical or theological context. And to a point, the original biblical criticism was not a bad thing. But what ended up happening is it became kind of the connotation of the word now, that people became critics of the Bible. They critiqued it. And they began to even decide, well, this part is inspired, this part is not, or that's not really what this says, this is what it really means, and begin to basically rewrite the Bible based upon, you know, popular opinion, popular belief, or their own thoughts and belief. And this was really gaining a lot of steam in the late 1800s. By the way, one of the leaders in that was Germany. Germany, the German rationalism, German higher criticism, just was, I mean, powerful, powerful stuff. It had a lot of appeal to the intellectual crowd, but it was a very damaging thing that had come upon Christianity. And by the way, I do believe there is a tie between that higher criticism that Germany exposed the world to, and then some 50, 60 years later, Nazism. I do think there is a general trend there, because they rejected traditional Christianity, sought to reform it to the modern times, and when they took away that foundation that their society had really been built on since Luther, they expose themselves to fall for anything, and that's exactly what they did in falling for Nazi socialism. But as I say, thankfully, boy, when somebody or a movement tends to attack Christianity or undermine Christianity, there are those who rise to the occasion, and thank God that there were many Christians who stood up against all this nonsense and defended true Christian doctrine. In fact, that you will find many wonderful works by great men from that time just, you know, defending and explaining true Christian doctrine because of the onslaught and the attacks from the modernist crowd. Now, originally these battles took place in almost every denomination of Christianity. The Baptists were not immune to that. I mean, there were battles even as late as the 20s and 30s inside the Presbyterian Church. There were battles inside the Methodist Church. The Congregational Church, I mean, most of the, so we say, Protestant denominations had this battle going on in them. And there actually were, you know, some of the same topics, you know, the inerrancy of the Scripture, the authority of the Scripture, the virgin birth of Christ, a lot of the miracles of Christ began to be questioned, and even some of the historical accuracy of the Bible began to be questioned, and events like the flood or Jonah and the whale, those things began to be questioned during this time. And this was just a broadside attack on Christianity, so every denomination seemed to face this a little bit. Now, for example, in the late 1800s, Charles Spurgeon, probably the greatest Baptist of the 1800s, at least the last half. I don't think you can find a more influential or more greatly used man than Charles Spurgeon during that time. But he began to sense this growing tend toward modernism in the English Baptist circles, especially in the Baptist Union, which he was part of. And he began to sound the warning and cry out about the dangers and the direction things were headed. And this controversy became known as the downgrade controversy, because Spurgeon believed that the Christian doctrine was being downgraded. And there's a number of articles he wrote in his Sword and Trowel publication on it. What ended up happening is Spurgeon ends up leaving the Baptist Union, in part basically kicked out as a troublemaker, but even these issues are still debated. The issues that he left, they're still. In fact, I was reading an article. I was looking up a little bit of information while I was writing this, and they're still looking back and saying, you know what, this battle isn't over. We're still fighting over some of this stuff. So it's an amazing thing. But Spurgeon was one of the first to really stand up, make a very public cry out about it, and it really hurt his reputation in Baptist circles for many years. Time now has kind of healed all wounds, you know, and people begin to have really embraced Spurgeon. But during the last part of his life, he was a very controversial figure because of his stands on this. Now, I think a key group, and so I've talked to a number of people who disagree with this, but I think a key group and movement to the formation of the Independent Fundamental Baptist movement is the Landmark Baptist. J.R. Graves was their leader. They had a number of other guys. They're kind of centered around Nashville, Tennessee. Graves had a paper called The Tennessee Baptist, which was very popular in the South. In fact, I read somewhere, and I've been trying to track this back down. I may have this wrong, but it was, I think, the most circulated paper in Texas at the time, even. So, about the time of the Civil War, this movement really began to take shape. They're known for strongly standing for Baptist principles and doctrine. They were hardcore Baptists. Now, they did take some stuff a little too far. A number of these guys became what we call Baptist briders, that basically, you know, the bride of Christ is only made up of people who are members of the true church, which, of course, is the Baptist church. There were some things like that that came out that they took stuff to an extreme. They did not, for instance, they did not consider a non-Baptist church to even be a church. They would call them a religious gathering or something along those lines. So very interesting. They're very, very fun books to read. J.R. Graves was a very gifted debater, and there's been this you know, new trend towards very sarcastic writing and stuff, kind of like an Ann Coulter is to in political spheres. Well, J.R. Graves was kind of that way at the time. He was a boy. He had a very sharp pen that he wielded, and very fun to read. Very fun to read. I have to admit, I have a couple of his books, and I enjoy reading them. I don't necessarily agree with all his conclusions, but it's very fun to read. Now, one of the key things to the formation of the Landmark Baptist was the Church of Christ. I don't have this in your notes, but the Church of Christ movement, which had split off of the Baptist in the early 1800s, really challenged Baptists to defend themselves, because the Church of Christ was claiming they were the true Baptist. And so there's a lot of debates throughout the 1800s into the 1900s. By now, we've kind of gone our separate ways and, you know, good riddance to each other, but at that time, it was a hotbed of debate, and J.R. Graves would speak quite a bit about the errors of Campbellism, Campbellites, as they called it back in the day. So, this group took a very strong stand for such things as local church autonomy and, as I say, just Baptist beliefs in general. A lot of writing on true baptism and did a lot of tremendous work. Now, what they did is they influenced Baptists really throughout the South of America. I mean, throughout the Southland, Tennessee was a hotbed for this stuff. And even today, Tennessee and Kentucky, there's a lot of Landmark Baptist churches. A lot of these guys stayed members of things like the Southern Baptist Convention. They didn't necessarily pull out. So what happened is, through their influence and through their teachings and stuff, it began to infiltrate into the Southern Baptist Convention. And so some of these beliefs, you can really trace. I mean, I'm telling you, 50 years later, you can still see some of their stuff in the early 1900s. For instance, in Texas Baptist history, You'll read about a man named S.E. Hayden who kind of questioned denominational stuff, and it was ugly, ugly fight that they had with him. And I mean, suing each other, people suing each other and stuff like that. In fact, a guy actually, well, I can't remember the guy's name, but they were on a train and he ran into Hayden and they got to arguing, and he actually pulled a gun and the gun went off. They got into a scuffle, and said, and he's a member of the First Baptist Church of Dallas, and they actually brought him up for like church discipline for trying to, you know, pulling a gun on a fellow Baptist. But they said that the group, you know, found him, you know, that he had done nothing wrong or something. They said if anything, they would have brought him up, you know, on charges for missing S.E. Hayden instead of, you know, not hitting him with the gun, or hitting him with a bullet. So, but anyway, very, very harsh fight. Well, what ended up happening, though, is Hayden kind of begins forming a new movement called the Baptist Missionary Association, BMA. I believe that's what it's called. It's BMA. I can't remember what the A stands for. Which is still, you know, they've got some influence around Texas and Arkansas, Louisiana. But they really embraced landmark principles. In fact, we're going to talk a little bit about J. Frank Norris. J. Frank Norris, in his early days, was called a Haydenite. That he was a, you know, he believed and followed some of the stuff Hayden spoke. So they're very well can be a direct link between J. Frank Norris, who I'm going to talk, I think, is kind of the father of the Independent Fundamental Baptist movement, and landmarkism to an extent. So. But anyway, now the fundamentalist movement was a non-denominational movement at first. It was a defense of historic Christianity. The name itself was based on a series of books called The Fundamentals that R.A. Torrey kind of started. I think it was A.C. Dixon that finished it. But a number of fundamentalists contributed to it. Now, I don't think J. Frank Norris did, but you'll see names like W.B. Reilly and T.T. Shields and J.C. Macy and... names like that of the leading fundamentalists of the time wrote articles for this series of books. You can actually buy a reprint of it today, and it's got a marginal value. It is really for its time, but it's still one of the first times that they actually sat down and tried to address all the issues, and was a very influential book at the time, or set of books. Now, this movement stood strong against higher criticism of the Bible, evolution especially. Most of the big crusading evangelists of the 20s and 30s, Billy Sunday, Mordecai Ham, guys like that, they were associated with the fundamentalist movement. And that's really when the movement reached its zenith, was in the 20s and 30s. By that time, it really began to fracture out and... It's pretty rare that you would see somebody nowadays claim to be a fundamentalist of that sort. There's very few of those left. The Great Depression did not help them, and World War II really did not help them. And especially after those things, people got away from wanting to take a hard stand, and that's when some more liberalism kind of stepped in. But now... it's not very clear how all the factors united, but as said before, if it's pretty unclear, but because of all the different sources and stuff, but if Independent Fundamental Baptists had a father to the movement, a leader, a founder, it was J. Frank Norris. Now, in the least, he was a trailblazer and a pioneer, and I don't think we would have an Independent Fundamental Baptist movement today without J. Frank Norris and his influence. Now, originally the Baptist circles kind of rebelled against the fundamentalist movement because it was kind of a non-denominational movement, and most Baptists still stuck to themselves for the most part during this day. Even the more liberal tended to do that. So, through the influence of Norris and W.B. Reilly and T.T. Shields, they really began to merge the fundamentalism into the Baptist circles, and really led the way for a lot of Baptists to become fundamentalists. In fact, I've read that Norris can trace a lot of things back to Norris, but I've in one book even said that fundamentalism was a northern movement before Norris, and after Norris, it was in the South. That he completely changed the geographic location of a movement. Through his influence. So the J. Frank Norris led the way for many Baptists to leave the strong denominational authorities like the Southern Baptist Convention and form groups, loosely knit groups, usually called fellowships, where basically they still had the semblance of a convention, but with a whole lot less authority. And there's many features of the Independent Fundamental Baptist Movement you can trace back directly to Norse, almost directly to Norse. Now, premillennialism is one. W.B. Riley was a premillennialist. At this time, Baptists were mostly postmillennialists, and it took till after World War I for them to kind of come to their senses on that. But as I say, now premillennialism is very, very popular in the Southern Baptist ranks. But Norris really helped to popularize it in Baptist circles. In fact, he wasn't a premillennialist at first. He became one through the influence of Louis Ensminger, of course, W.B. Riley to an extent. Door-to-door evangelism is something else he helped to pioneer and helped to pass on in the movement. That's a key feature and almost a sacrament in most churches, in Fundamental Baptist churches. And that's something you can trace back to Norris. There's not a whole lot of that went on before him. Tenacious defense of doctrine. Norris, oh boy, did he stand firm, and he would call you all kinds of names and call you out for espousing to, you know, modernism and questioning, you know, Christian doctrine. His disdain for conventions and boards can be seen. Now, he was a very strong leader, and one of his faults probably was that he meddled too much in affairs and tried to rule too much stuff. But still, he led the way in people leaving, like the Southern Baptist Convention, Northern Baptist Convention, and getting in the more loosely knit fellowships. Practical training through Bible colleges is something else he helped to popularize. In fact, his college, Bible Baptist Seminary, at the time, it went through a couple different names, but at one time during World War II, actually was the only unaccredited religious school that was eligible to receive VA benefits. So the soldiers who came back could use their VA benefits to attend that school, and kind of had some friends in Washington help them out on that one. But he helped to popularize that, whereas an unaccredited institution, and most of the training was very practical, ministry-related. They kind of avoided theology and different things that a more traditional seminary approach would take. Norris helped to popularize that, and that's a kind of a hallmark of Independent Fundamental Baptist Movement. And one thing, and the last thing that I have listed here, and you can probably talk about a lot more, but strong pastoral authority before Norris. Really, a lot of power rested on deacons and boards and such. But after Norris, you see a lot more churches rely more on the pastor as the central figure, and having very weak deacon boards and such. And even that is kind of now beginning to catch on in some Southern Baptist churches. They've kind of had especially on the deacons, have gone back to a more biblical example where the deacons don't run the church as like a Presbyterian form of government, but they actually get back to more of a servant leadership deal. Now, Norris was far from perfect. Oh, was he far from perfect. He had a number of things that you could question him on, but he was a trailblazer. I like to think of it as, in this context, when you think about the pioneers moving into Western America, that, you know, the original guys who moved after were the mountain men, these guys that just lived right on the fringe of society. And to do that, you know, these guys almost had to be a little half-touched in the head, okay? They had to be a little half-crazy to live way out in the middle of nowhere, no contact with civilization. And but those were the guys that originally would go in and set up camps and stuff, which would then become villages and towns and But, you know, they were kind of the trailblazers to that movement. Kit Carson was kind of that way to an extent. Well, Norris was kind of that way in trailblazing the Independent Fundamental Baptist Movement. He did a lot of things you can question. He was a fighter and did not back down from a fight. And if there wasn't one, he might start one. But part of that was he was elbowing room and making a place for this new movement that he was spearheading. practically every major independent fundamental Baptist leader can in some way be traced back to Norris, especially back in those early days. Nowadays, a little more difficult, but for instance, John R. Rice worked with Norris for a few years. They would end up parting on less than ideal terms. In fact, they weren't even friends to begin with, but over the fight about Baylor University and evolution there, John R. Rice first defended Baylor. He was a graduate from there, and so was Norris. But it came to the point that Rice acknowledged that and worked with Norris for a few years. And as I said, they did leave on less than ideal terms, and John Rice respected him, but he even said, you know, he said, I can't take his paper. This is there's too much name calling and stuff in there that's not good for edifying. So even John Rice had to back off to an extent. Tom Malone, you know, leader up in Michigan, was considered one time as a possible pastor for the First Baptist Church of Fort Worth. Norris was up in years. They were kind of seeking out people to take the pastorate because he was just physically unable to. And Tom Malone was considered that, so that kind of gives him a tie to the movement. G.B. Vick was a longtime associate of Norris and helped in many things, the seminary and the church, and especially in Detroit, which he ended up pastoring after they voted Norris out. But he was one of the leaders in founding the Baptist Bible Fellowship. So even that movement has its roots in Norris. Many other independent fundamental Baptist leaders took inspiration from Norris. They copied his methods. His Sunday school system that he and Ensminger developed, especially Ensminger, copied by many people. When Elmer Towns wrote his book on the 10 largest Sunday schools in America back, I think he wrote that book back in the 60s or 70s. Most of those, I think it's 8 or 9, I don't remember exactly, of those Sunday schools used the Ensminger system that Norris used. So, stuff like that, his door-to-door visitation, Norton, a lot of people have copied Norris methods. All right, now I've already talked about that last sentence there. Well, to wrap this up, the independent fundamental Baptist movement has been a very influential one. Now, have they changed the course of Christian history? No, they really haven't. But I tell you, they have made an impact on America. But before the rise of the megachurch movement, most of the largest churches in America had ties to the independent fundamental Baptist movement. I heard Bob Smith, pastor of Trinity Baptist in Arlington, Texas, state one time that in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, just for an example, that there were 10 churches with over 1,000 people membership that were independent fundamental Baptist churches. And now I think that's down to 1, as the movement's kind of beginning to fall apart to an extent, but at one time most of the large churches, Jack Hiles and his First Baptist Church Hammond, and before that his church in Dallas, I've lost the name of it, but even those were very large churches for the time. Dallas Billington had the largest church for a long time, and he had ties to Norris, Akron Baptist Temple. In fact, he kind of took away that largest church moniker away from Norris, and that's part of Norris's motivation in taking Detroit Baptist Temple when he had the two pastorates in Fort Worth and in Detroit, but so he could have the largest congregation again. Not a lot of people since that, but I do think that was a motivation in that. Influence is felt in other groups in emphasizing soul winning, defending fundamentals of the Christian faith. Adrian Rogers, for example, former president of the Southern Baptist Convention, very influential man and very great man of God. I really enjoy listening to him preach on the radio and stuff. But if you get his biography, there's a list in the back of it of men who influenced him, and one of them is John R. Rice, and talks about how John R. Rice's stand and soul winning and stuff really greatly influenced Adrian Rogers. So you can see from an outside perspective, even the independent fundamental Baptist movement has had an impact in keeping groups like the Southern Baptist Convention a little bit more conservative and stirring some soul-winning fires in them. As I said before, many megachurches use a small group system, which is very similar, and I think in origin can be traced back to the Norris Insminger Sunday school system. That's part of how Norris was helped to build. He could draw large crowds, he couldn't keep them. And with Insminger, they developed the Sunday school system where they could grow and keep people in the church through the Sunday school. But it's just a slight modification of it, and really a different purpose to it, but it's a slight modification of that system that Bill Hybels and groups like that use in their mega churches. Now, today, the Independent Fundamental Baptist movement is really a shadow of its former self. There's really not a national leader anymore. Guys like Rice and Hiles and Malone and Robertson, those guys have all passed off the scene. It's still a very live movement, and it's still a very very powerful one in some areas, but it's really began to fracture into more regional movements, and leaders are more regionally based. So you'll have a guy in California who's very popular in California, but somebody in Georgia may have never heard of him. But the group in Georgia has their group of preachers that the guy in California may never, have preached in his church. So that, it really tends to kind of be that it's a very regional movement. There's a few guys that have some more national impact and will preach in conferences and stuff across America. But for the most part, major influence is regional. And, there were times at the Independent Fundamental Baptist movement that there was one or two Bible colleges that everybody went to, whether that be Tennessee Temple or Hiles Anderson. Nowadays, there are many, many Bible colleges throughout the nation. So a lot of times people don't have to travel halfway across the country. They can go halfway across the state or into a neighboring state to go to Bible college. So as I say, it's really come to the point now, it has become a very regional movement. And even in that, you're starting to see some splintering based on some differences of doctrinal opinion. There's not the great unifying battles and rally cries that there were in the past around evolution or the King James Bible. Those have really, it's not that they're not major issues, and it's not that they're still being debated. It's just that mainstream Christianity has long passed those by, and they don't garner as much influence or attention as they once did. And even inside our movement, I think people have grown tired of that because, a lot of the battles have been faced, same for 20, 30 years, and people have grown tired of it. But still, there are hundreds of churches that trace their origins or membership, I guess you could say, to the Independent Fundamental Baptist movement. I saw stats that said just on Norris himself that there were 2,500 to 3,000 churches that were begun or associated with him or the derivative movements from him. That's a lot of impact. Now, the Independent Fundamental Baptist movement has never been an intellectual one. It's always been more practical. It's always been based in reaching people for Christ, for standing for the fundamentals of the faith. And a lot of people have dismissed it as, oh, those were just a bunch of uneducated, simple people. But major churches have been built out of just ordinary, average people who don't have, PhDs and doctorates, and who are not, the great influential people in society, but just normal, average, everyday people have built some of the greatest churches in the history of Christendom through the Independent Fundamental Baptist movement. So that's going to wrap it up. I've kind of rambled a little bit into some stuff that isn't in the notes, but I really felt like I needed to cover that just because a lot of people don't, and I don't think a lot of people know how. But I just didn't feel right with leaving a Baptist history course without touching on the Independent Fundamental Baptist movement, because that say I'm a member of that. I am one of those, and I know a lot of people that frequent my website are also. My website is unashamedly Independent Fundamental Baptist. It's on the front page. So I wanted to throw that in there and not really address Baptists as a whole in the last deal, but really focus on the movement I'm a part, because, as I say, not many people do it. I hope that this lesson has been a help to you. I hope you have enjoyed this series. Now, you'll notice in your notes that I have an appendix, and I'll kind of go over it real quick with you. I have a list of recommended Baptist history books. I'll just kind of go over this real quick. Faithful Baptist Witness by Phil Stringer is a very good one. Little paperback book. It is not footnoted. That's its major fault. It really was not designed to be a textbook. It was designed to kind of accompany a high school Baptist history course. But it's a very good book. A lot of good information. It needs to be footnoted. But if you want a good overview of the Independent Fundamental Baptist view of church history, that's a very good one. Another influential book is The Trail of Blood by J.M. Carroll. You'll see it's based on a series of lectures given to Ashland Avenue Baptist Church in Lexington, Kentucky. And it's a little bitty paperback. It's got a chart that you really can't understand that comes with it, with a lot of little red dots that are supposed to represent persecution and stuff. But it's okay. I think he covers a lot more Catholic stuff than he does Baptist and bashing Catholic doctrine and stuff. But anyway, it's very popular. A lot of people really like it. So that's another one. Short History of the Baptist by Henry Vedder is a kind of a classic work. It's about 400 pages, so it's not very short. But it covers a lot of history. And it's pretty good. Now, his contention is that Baptist principles have always existed, and then they finally all came together and kind of formed the Baptist movement. So he's kind of got a different take on it, but the information is very good. And of a one volume book to cover the history and stuff, that is a pretty good one as far as Baptist history books go. Now, some other books, you might see one by History of the Baptist by Robert Torbay. I happen to have that one, and he doesn't believe in Baptist succession. He's, you know, one of these 400-year-old Baptist guys. Also has some liberal opinions and stuff in there, but you might see that one. Another one that's pretty popular right now is The Baptist Heritage, Four Centuries of Baptist Witness by H. Leon Macbeth. Southern Baptist book there. He's a historian on staff at Southwestern Baptist Theological Seminary in Fort Worth, Texas. It's very well documented, very well done. I cannot give him enough credit for probably being the most researched, most founded Baptist history book. Unfortunately, he only believes in 400 years of Baptist history. Those 400 years he covers very well. Now, it is from a Southern Baptist, a little bit more liberal perspective than I personally enjoy, but I do respect the fact that it is very well documented, very well done. Now, there's a companion volume for that I really like called A Source Book for Baptist Heritage that has a lot of the source documents. It's pretty neat to have, just because it has portions of, you know, influential writings or things like that. Even J. Frank Norris, there's some stuff in there about him. So that's a very interesting book. If you really want some hardcore information, that's a good one. But as I say, that book, because he only believes in four centuries, and he's going to really, really push the convention view on things, I don't really highly recommend it. But as I say, it is probably the most researched one-volume book that you'll find. Now, here's some other books you'll see that are online, that you can find if you go to books.google.com or reformreader.org, which is a Calvinist website, but they have a lot of Baptist history books. A lot of these are public domain. You can read them online. Baptist Thorough Reformers by John Q. Adams, not John Quincy Adams, but John Q. Adams. That was supposedly the book that Spurgeon used in his pastor's college. So History of the Baptist by Thomas Armitage, very popular. History of the Baptist by John T. Christian is a pretty popular book, probably the most thorough researched book on Baptist succession that you will find. He was a teacher at New Orleans Baptist Theological Seminary, something like that, whatever the name it was, but he's a teacher down in New Orleans at the Baptist Seminary down there. And very well researched. If you can find a copy of it, that's probably the most researched footnoted one that you will find. Baptist History by J.M. Cramp, you'll see that. Origin of the Baptist by S.H. Ford. Concise History of the Baptist by G.H. Orchard. Now, that one tends to be a little bit more on the English side, if I remember right. And, of course, Short History of the Baptist by Henry Vedder. A lot of these books were written in the 1800s. Now, Christians was written in the early 1900s, but a lot of these were written in the 1800s when there really was this resurgence in Baptist identity. And some of these have ties to even the landmark movement. So, but anyway, if you want to do some research, you can find those books online. They're public domain now, and people have taken the time to place them online. So if you want to do a little quick reading on it, you don't have to go to Barnes & Noble. You can just search the internet, and you can find a lot of these. So that'll wrap up this course. I apologize for taking a little longer to finish up that last lesson. I did the other 9 lessons in one sitting, recorded them when I was doing some for my job, doing some training, and I was sitting in the hotel room and did all those, and taking me a little while. I never did like the lesson 10, and my voice was shot by the time I got to recording that. So finally got a chance to re-record it, and we'll get this course wrapped up. And I sure do appreciate you listening, and I hope it's been a help and a blessing to you. And boy, we've gone a long time. I knew I had. We're pushing over 46 minutes now. But I do appreciate you listening. God bless you in your studies and in your search for truth. And I hope to have you listening in on another course very soon, and stay in touch. I appreciate it. And Matthew Gage, BaptistBasics.org, Baptist Basics University, and I do thank you for listening.